I want to talk today about the problem of the significance of the historical Jesus for Christian ethics. Should a treatment of New Testament ethics begin with a historical reconstruction of the teaching of Jesus? As I noted yesterday, Wolfgang Schrage, who conceives of New Testament ethics as a historical project, answers this question affirmatively. And so he makes the methodological decision to open his book with a very long chapter, more than 100 pages in length, on the ethics proclaimed by the Jesus of history. This has been a typical way for New Testament scholars writing books on New Testament ethics to organize their work. On the other hand, in my book, The Moral Vision of the New Testament, I argued that New Testament ethics should be concerned primarily with the content of the canonical portraits of the life and teachings of Jesus, rather than with a historian's reconstruction of the events behind these portrayals. And so in my book, I place the discussion of the role of the historical Jesus in a brief excursus of about 10 pages, which follows individual chapters on each of the four canonical Gospels, each one considered in its own right as a primary voice in the New Testament chorus. Now, this procedure has attracted some controversy from various sides. Some reviewers have questioned my decision to give such a minor place to the historical Jesus in a presentation of New Testament ethics. While, on the other hand, at least one reviewer, Luke Timothy Johnson, has criticized my book for paying any attention to the question at all. He describes my short chapter on Jesus as, quote, an unfortunately wrong turn. He continues as follows, quote, not only does Hayes inadvertently play directly into the hands of those who wish to hold the Christian tradition hostage to the ever-shifting conclusions of historical inquiry, but he diminishes the critical role played by convictions concerning Jesus' death and resurrection for shaping the image of Jesus that stands at the heart of Hayes's single fundamental story. End quote. Another way to put Johnson's point would be as follows. The image of Jesus that matters for New Testament ethics is the image portrayed by the kerygma, the proclaimed gospel of the church. Therefore, what historians say about Jesus simply doesn't matter. And Johnson thinks that for me even to treat it in an excursus in the book is to give hostages to fortune. Well, in light of these responses, I want to reopen the question with you here today. What can we really know about the Jesus of history? And what role should our account of Jesus as a historical figure play in New Testament ethics? When confronted by this difficult question, I always recall an apocryphal story about Paul Tillich. It seems that back in the 1950s, a team of Roman Catholic archaeologists conducting a dig in Jerusalem discovered the tomb of Jesus and found, to their horror, his bones still in the tomb. They dutifully called the Pope and informed him of this disturbing discovery. The Pope decided that before making any sort of public statement, he should convene a secret ecumenical council to ponder the church's response to this crisis. And so he asked his advisors who was the greatest Protestant theologian, and he was told that it was Paul Tillich. Of course, he was misinformed about that. It was Karl Barth, or perhaps in light of Gordon's comments yesterday, Reinhold Niebuhr, who also would have been a better choice, but never mind. So the Pope placed a long-distance phone call to Tillich at Union Theological Seminary in New York and carefully explained the troubling news that the archaeologists had found the bones of Jesus still in the tomb. There was a long silence at the other end of the line. And finally, Tillich responded, "So then, he really did live." Well, we chuckle at this story because it plays upon a strange fact of our recent theological history. Much 20th century theology has assumed that the Jesus of history is unknowable. Thus, Tillich tried to formulate a Christology that was detached from the Jesus of history. And he was by no means alone in this. He was, of course, influenced by Rudolf Bultmann, and much New Testament scholarship in the middle of this century under Bultmann's influence was engaged in a similar project. As you may know, in his Theology of the New Testament, Bultmann famously argued that the preaching of Jesus does not belong to the theology of the New Testament, properly speaking, but rather to the presuppositions of a theology of the New Testament. Well, recently, however, in about the last 15, 20 years, we've seen a renewed effort to give a purely historical account of Jesus, an account free from the control of Christian doctrine and tradition. I say a renewed effort because in many respects this recent quest is nothing other than the revival of 19th century liberalism's project of portraying Jesus as a model of enlightened reason, separated decisively from anything too Jewish, and particularly separated from any taint of apocalyptic eschatology. The most notorious purveyors of this new fictional non-Jewish Jesus have been, of course, the members of the Jesus Seminar, led by Robert Funk, John Dominic Crossan, and Burton Mack. Their influence has spread widely. Some of you may have seen, for instance, an exchange of letters in the Christian Century in which a reader protested against an article I had published there. The reader, an ordained Episcopal priest, asserted that, quote, "The Gospels do not reveal Jesus. Instead, they reveal what various first century communities wanted themselves and others to believe about Jesus," end quote. Now, there have been several devastating critiques of the Jesus Seminar offered by serious New Testament scholars, particularly by the work of Luke Timothy Johnson and N.T. Wright. And I therefore am not going to waste your time by offering an extended rebuttal to the work of the Jesus Seminar. Suffice it to say that I think their work is tendentious fantasy. It's deeply flawed in its methods, and no one should regard its findings as serious critical history. More pertinent to the question I want to raise today are the issues that are raised by Johnson in his book, The Real Jesus, The Misguided Quest for the Historical Jesus and the Truth of the Traditional Gospels. Johnson wins the award, I think, for the most clearly polemical book title of recent years. After exposing the absurdity of the claims of the Jesus Seminar, Johnson goes on to argue that Christian faith has never been based on the historical Jesus. Rather, he writes, quote, "Christian faith then and now is based on religious claims concerning the present power of Jesus," end quote. History, as Johnson explains it, is a very limited mode of knowing that can't deal at all with the truths that are the most important and most real. Especially the resurrection of Jesus, Johnson insists, simply is not an event that is accessible to historical inquiry. So the real Jesus of Johnson's title is the living Lord encountered in the church's present experience. We know this living Lord not through historical inquiry, but through encountering his transforming power in our lives. Indeed, Johnson seems virtually to equate the meaning of resurrection with this experience of transforming power now in the church. As a Roman Catholic, Johnson tends to assume that this encounter occurs through the mediation of tradition and sacrament. In other words, Johnson's book responds to the question, what can we really know about Jesus, by carefully reframing the meaning of the verb to know. What we know most certainly is not to be found, Johnson argues, in the realm of fact and history, but rather in the realm of religious experience. Now, in my judgment, this is a theologically perilous move. By placing history and truth in separate compartments, Johnson reinforces the post-Kantian split between faith and history in a way that I find deeply problematical. I want to argue instead that faith and history stand necessarily in a dialogical relationship with one another. Precisely because of the character of the New Testament witnesses themselves, faith cannot cut itself loose from history in the way that Johnson recommends. So I propose then to do two things here this morning. First, I want to offer a brief response to Johnson by indicating why we should care about the historical Jesus and why our investigation of this problem might be significant for New Testament ethics, which after all is the overall concern of these lectures. And secondly, I want to turn then to engage the recent work of N.T. Wright, particularly his major new book, Jesus and the Victory of God, and explore how Wright's particular proposals about the Jesus of history might be significant for New Testament ethics. So I think this juxtaposition of Johnson and Wright will nicely illustrate the issues that I want to discuss here. First, why should we care about the historical Jesus? As I've indicated, Luke Johnson has posed a strong challenge to the project of reconstructing the historical Jesus by arguing the things that really matter are not accessible to historical investigation and that the real Jesus is known to the church in its living experience, not through historical reconstruction. In light of this challenge, why should we undertake the effort as historians and as Christians to explore what we can know historically about the figure of Jesus? As we try to sort this out, it's important to make a distinction here between the Jesus of history, that is the flesh and blood human being Jesus of Nazareth, who lived in first century Palestine, and on the other hand, the historian's reconstruction of that figure. The phrase historical Jesus is ambiguous because it can mean either of those two things, which are not precisely identical. The historian's reconstruction is always at best an account, a tentative approximation of the historical figure himself. But there's no knowledge of that historical figure except through some such reconstruction. Indeed, our canonical gospels, I would argue, are in fact the earliest attempt to render such accounts of that historical figure, even though they're not histories in the modern sense of that word. So I would suggest that our reasons for attending to this project of interpreting Jesus historically are at least of three sorts. First, we're compelled to do it by the character of the New Testament witnesses themselves. Secondly, we're compelled to it by the question of truth. And thirdly, we're compelled to it as a theological matter by the internal logic of Christian doctrine. Let me say something about each of these factors in turn, briefly. First, the character of the New Testament witnesses themselves. It's a very significant fact that we have four Gospels in our New Testament canon, not just one. The church was emphatic early on in rejecting either the move of Marcion to limit the gospel canon by cutting it down to a single gospel, and it was equally emphatic in the end in rejecting Tatian's Diatessaron, which was an effort to produce a single gospel harmony that conflated all four together. But there's an insistence on retaining the fourfold gospel canon, four distinct and different portraits. How are we to account for this? There's a kind of rudimentary curiosity that inevitably arises. When I teach Introduction to New Testament for students in seminary, my approach to doing that is, as in my also in my ethics book, not to begin with the historical Jesus. This is the way, again, New Testament courses have traditionally been taught for a long time, that you start with the historical Jesus, and then you talk about the traditions about him in the early oral tradition in the community, and then you talk about how the gospel writers as redactors pulled those traditions together into the compositions that now exist. But instead of doing that, I began just by looking in sequential order at the four canonical portraits, just the four different pictures that are painted there of Jesus. And what I find is that by the time we get to the end of looking at those four portraits, most of my students are practically climbing the walls wanting to ask the historical question, yeah, but what really happened? What's behind this? Because they see that there are ways in which these stories are simply told differently. Gospel of John has Jesus' action of driving the money changers out of the temple at the beginning of the narrative instead of at the end, for example, as in the synoptics. Why is that? Which way is right? Which way did it happen? So I think that there are, of course, various ways to deal with this problem, but certainly one of the ways that is, I think, unavoidable to us is to try to understand what history lies behind the accounts and how and why they developed in the way they did. A second aspect of this character of the New Testament witnesses themselves is that these gospel texts are referential narratives. That is, they tell stories about events that happened in the past, the recent past, for the original authors and readers, and they ask readers to accept these accounts as true. Read the prologue of Luke's gospel, the opening four verses of chapter 1 of Luke. And he says, I've been investigating these things for some time, and I want to set down an orderly account in order that you might be given confidence of the truth of the things you've been taught. This question about the Jesus of history arises then not merely because of some unbelieving perversity, but it arises because of the form in which the Gospels themselves have chosen to bear witness. Unlike the Church's historic creeds, the Gospels do not skip from Jesus' virgin birth to his crucifixion under Pontius Pilate with nothing in between. I don't know, do Mennonites say the Apostles' Creed? Do you? Yeah, okay. Well, you know how the creed goes, born of the Virgin Mary, suffered under Pontius Pilate, and nothing happened, apparently, in between those events. He was crucified, dead, and buried. Well, the Gospels aren't like that. His teachings and healings, his eating with sinners, and his other doings are narrated as crucial disclosures of his identity. Surely there's something at stake in the question of whether these stories correspond to real events in space-time history. Johnson's desire to place history and faith in separate, hermetically sealed spheres would have been unintelligible to the gospel writers, and even to Paul, who believed that if you were inclined to doubt the resurrection, you could go ask those 500 brethren, most of whom were still alive 20 years later when Paul wrote to the Corinthians. So my point is that the kerygma itself involves referential claims about certain narrated events. And even the creed, with its reference to Jesus' crucifixion under Pontius Pilate, takes pains to locate the critical events of Jesus' death on the stage of world history. The gospel is not only the offer of some kind of new self-understanding, but it's a proclamation that certain events happened among flesh and blood people in history, and that these events have somehow wrought a fundamental transformation in our relationship to God. That's why the Gospels take the form they do. They're not timeless teachings. They're not mystical revelations from heaven. They're not celebrations of the author's own personal relationship with Jesus, but they are history-like narratives. So that's the first point, is why we should care, the character of the witnesses themselves. The second point, closely linked, is the question of truth. We pursue historical inquiry because of our own innate, God-given, God-driven desire to know the truth. Intellectual integrity demands it. We're not just play-acting, living in some imaginary magic kingdom of Disney Bible land. This doesn't mean, as the Jesus Seminar crowd supposes, that we have to tailor the content of Christian preaching to include only what a historian can accept. But it does mean we want to know whether the gospel we preach is somehow continuous with events, rooted in events that happened in real space-time history, and whether this preaching is in some sense faithful to those events or whether it's simply fantasy. Now, of course, historical evidence can never prove the truth of the gospel. Even if the narrative of Jesus' death and resurrection is historically factual, that doesn't prove that these events occurred for us and for our salvation. You see, that's a different matter to interpret the significance of those events in that way. But if the referential claims are fundamentally false, then as Paul says, we are of all people most to be pitied. We're living a lie, and the whole thing has to be seen as a pious fiction, a human aspiration writ large. It's no longer something outside ourselves, but rather we become subject to the charges of Feuerbach and Freud that the gospel is simply wishful thinking, the projection of our human hopes and needs. So, what I'm saying is that historical investigation can't prove the truth of the gospel, but it might disprove it. Why then do it? Because otherwise our preaching and our faith becomes unchecked ideology. By pressing the question about the Jesus of history, we seek to avoid falling into a sentimental morass of religious subjectivity that ignores the question of what God has actually done in the world. As Leander Keck has argued, the historical inquiry then has the effect of interrogating our religious convictions and allowing the Jesus of history to pose questions to us, questions to the image of him that the church builds up over time. So our attempt at historical reflection, speaking from within the church, stands in a dialectical, cross-checking relation with our confessional traditions. As Anselm formulated it, not about the historical Jesus, but about other matters, it's a question of fides quaerens intellectum, faith-seeking understanding. Finally, the third point I want to make concerns the internal logic of Christian doctrine. There are three points I want to make here about the way in which the internal logic of Christian doctrine requires this historical inquiry. First, the doctrine of incarnation. If Jesus of Nazareth was a real human being who lived in a particular place, that is Galilee and Judea in the first century, then his life may be investigated historically in precisely the same way as the life of any other human being, whether Socrates, Julius Caesar, Martin Luther, or Martin Luther King, Jr. It doesn't follow that historical investigation can tell us everything we want to know about Jesus, far from it. The sources are too limited. But there's nothing in principle appropriate about the investigation. If that's not true, if we claim that Jesus is somehow beyond the scope of historical inquiry, are we not falling unwittingly into docetism, that is, denying that he was a real human being? The Christ of faith is the Jesus of history, Jesus of Nazareth. So the apostles proclaimed, so the church has insisted. That's the scandal of the particularity of the incarnation. Let me put the question this way. Does it matter, in fact, if Jesus of Nazareth was dragged kicking and screaming against his will to the cross? Does it? It seems to me that Johnson would have to answer in principle, no, it doesn't matter. What matters is the way the story is told in the gospel proclamations. But I think that there's something more at stake in the particularity of Jesus' humanity. I think it matters that the flesh and blood man Jesus did live the obedience of faith, obedience even unto death on a cross, because his example teaches us that to trust in the power of God is not to trust in vain. Second point about the internal logic of Christian doctrine concerns the eschatological reservation. Johnson seems to affirm that Jesus can be known in a fully satisfactory way through his presence in the church now. And of course, there are precedents for this view in the New Testament, particularly the Gospel of John. But this seems to me to be a one-sided account of the New Testament witness, which also insists that we do not yet see him as we desire, that we walk by faith, not by sight. Alongside John, we have the Gospel of Mark, whose glad tidings conclude with the mysterious figure at the tomb saying to the women, "He is risen, he is not here." We have a foretaste in the Spirit, but we don't enjoy his unmediated presence. That's why the popular language that one hears in some forms of evangelical Christianity about having a personal relationship with Jesus, language which, by the way, is entirely unbiblical, that's why that language strikes us, or strikes me anyway, as glib and disingenuous. It simply doesn't do justice to the New Testament's eschatological reservation, the awareness of the not yet, the insistence that we hope for what we do not see. In this eschatological interval, our hope must take its bearings in a significant way from what has been given us in the historical past. Third point concerning the internal logic of Christian doctrine concerns the significance of the people Israel. One aspect of the way that the story of Jesus comes to us in the Gospels is that Jesus lived and died as a Jew. His teachings were deeply grounded in Israel's traditions, and his hope for the future was inextricably interwoven with the fate of the people Israel. One glaring error of the Jesus seminar crowd is that they drive a wedge between Jesus and Jewish culture. That is simply bad history. And it could also, I'm persuaded, have disastrous theological and practical consequences. The last equally sustained effort to portray an un-Jewish Jesus was undertaken by the theologians of the Third Reich. But I'm worried that in a more subtle way, even Johnson's approach will also lead us away from the Jewishness of Jesus and the significance of Israel. If all we need to know about Jesus we learned in the Christian liturgy, or in the experience of our own prayer lives, then the ties of this Jesus to his people, a particular people distant from us in time and culture, may become increasingly tenuous. And the end product of this is a Jesus who is a Christian. That, in fact, is a dangerous distortion. And I think it's been a demonstrable phenomenon in the history of the church. So I'd like to suggest that there's much to be gained theologically by insisting on seeing Jesus in his first century Jewish historical context. In order to illustrate that, I want to turn now away from my rebuttal to Johnson and discuss the contributions of N.T. Wright. I assume that many of you will be acquainted, at least to some degree, with Wright's work. Wright, as you may know, is a brilliant British New Testament scholar. He taught for a time at McGill University in Montreal. Then he returned to England, where he became chaplain at Worcester College and lecturer in New Testament at Oxford. More recently, he's become the dean of Lichfield Cathedral in England. He's a highly visible speaker and writer. He's constantly being asked to go on the BBC and do one thing or another. And his much-awaited book, Jesus and the Victory of God, appeared last year. It's a massive... my New Testament ethics book. And he takes on here the question of the Jesus of history and challenges us to rethink everything we thought we knew. I want to consider with you how this book might be pertinent for our consideration of New Testament ethics, though Wright himself does not address this question directly in the book. My comments will be broken into four parts. First, I want to sketch the overall contours of Wright's portrait of the historical Jesus. Secondly, I'm going to offer some focused observations pertinent to the question of ethics within Wright's portrait. Third, I want to list briefly a few points where I think Wright's construction is open to critique. And then finally, I'll end by offering some reflections on the significance of this particular construction of the historical Jesus for New Testament ethics. So this will be a bit of a quick tour de force to work through all of that, but I think it can be done here within the time. First, Wright's portrayal of Jesus. This is a bold, sweeping proposal that tries to integrate the data of the gospel traditions in a totally fresh and rather surprising way, and to stand against the stream of a lot of the current historical Jesus research. As you may know, the people in the Jesus seminar group have been portraying Jesus as essentially a kind of wandering, cynic philosopher who simply went around spouting mysterious aphorisms, but someone who didn't have any kind of particular religious or political commitments or program, and who didn't have any sense of himself as being any sort of unique figure, didn't have any sense of any eschatological or apocalyptic expectations for the future. Well, Wright, on the other hand, insists, no, we have to understand Jesus as a first century Jewish apocalyptic prophet. He came proclaiming the kingdom of God, by which he meant several things. He meant, first of all, the restoration of Israel from exile. Now, this is one of the rather curious points, actually, about Wright's construction. Wright wants to argue that even though first century Jews were living in the land of Israel and had the temple intact, they nonetheless thought of themselves as being still in exile, never having returned from the exile, because they were still under the thumb of foreign oppressors and client rulers and so on, and Yahweh had not really come triumphantly to restore the Davidic monarchy, so they were still in exile. Secondly, this proclamation of the kingdom of God entailed the claim that God was about to act, or was in fact now acting, to bring about the final triumph over the powers of evil and human suffering. And thirdly, as an integral part of this, the proclamation of the kingdom of God meant that Yahweh was about to return to Zion and manifest his glory. Jesus believed, Wright argues, that all of this was taking place in and through his own ministry. In other words, Jesus did not come teaching people how to go to heaven when they die. Jesus did not come proclaiming some future cosmic event that would bring about the end of the space-time universe. But Wright wants to take all of the apocalyptic language in the Gospels and reinterpret it as a kind of coded language referring to specific historical events that Jesus believed would happen in the near future, the lifetime of himself and his immediate followers. Wright here, of course, is following very closely the work of Albert Schweitzer in his classic reconstruction of the historical Jesus. This message that Jesus came proclaiming had two quite distinct prongs to it. On the other hand, it was a glad and joyous message of hope and restoration and comfort, welcome to sinners who could at last be received into this coming kingdom. But at the same time, it carried a warning of imminent catastrophe. If Israel did not change its ways, catastrophe was going to come upon them. So Wright argues that Jesus ought to be understood as being just like the Old Testament prophets, like Amos and Jeremiah, proclaiming that a great disaster was going to befall the unfaithful nation Israel. Now notice how this portrayal of Jesus places him on the ground in the context of the political and religious history of first century Judaism. It also makes clear that in Wright's reconstruction, Jesus is engaged in a powerful critique of first century Judaism. The main elements, as I understand them, in Wright's critique are these. First of all, Jesus criticized Judaism because of its narrowness, its insistence on clinging to election as a matter of privilege and acting in a way that is exclusive and really, in fact, hostile and heedless towards the outside pagan world, which is, on Wright's reading, a betrayal of that for which God had destined Israel, namely to be a light to the nations, as we read in Isaiah. Wright believes that this was Jesus' view of the matter. Secondly, and connected closely with that, in particular, the disastrous course that Israel was on had to do with their commitment to nationalism and violence. On Wright's reconstruction, the revolutionary resistance movement against Roman rule was a powerful force bubbling all through first century Judaism. And indeed, Wright argues that even the Pharisees, who are not particularly portrayed this way in the Gospels, but that the Pharisees themselves were also essentially committed to programs of national revolutionary zealot violence. Against all of this, Jesus came proclaiming a new way of being the people of God, a new construal of Israel's worldview symbols. Jesus, according to Wright, attacked what had become the standard symbols of the Second Temple Judaism worldview, particularly on the issues of Sabbath, food laws, and worship in the temple, all of which were signs of this exclusivity that Jesus was criticizing. There's a very long last part of the book where Wright discusses Jesus' aims and beliefs, what we would call Jesus' own self-interpretation, self-understanding. Wright argues that Jesus was enacting in his own person in his final journey to Jerusalem these elements of return from exile, defeat of evil, and the return of Yahweh to Zion. He believed he was the Messiah. The fortunes of the people were drawn together onto himself and his own work, end quote. And when Jesus went to Jerusalem for his final confrontation with the authorities, he undertook three great symbolic actions. The first great symbolic action is the turning over of the tables and driving the money changers out of the temple. Wright interprets this as an act of judgment, God's judgment prefiguring the destruction of the whole system of temple worship. The second great symbolic action is the Last Supper, which symbolizes the enactment of a new exodus, a new coming to freedom and manifestation of the delivering power of God. And then finally, in a complex argument, Wright argues that Jesus' action of going to the cross is itself a prophetic symbolic action, which Jesus knowingly and deliberately undertook and submitted himself to as a way of enacting in his own person God's judgment on the unfaithful people Israel, and at the same time bringing about the final defeat of the power of evil. Well, that's a very quick sketch of Wright's extremely lengthy and complex construction. Now, I want to make, in the context of that overall sketch, some specific observations pertinent to ethics. The section that's most relevant to our concerns about New Testament ethics appears in the section where Wright is outlining the message that Jesus proclaimed in a chapter called Stories of the Kingdom, Invitation, Welcome, Challenge, and Summons. I want to read you an excerpt from the beginning of that chapter that gives you an overview of the way in which Jesus' proclamation is pertinent to the question of ethics. He writes, quote, "Jesus' kingdom narratives carried as part of their storyline the sense that his hearers were invited to see themselves as the Israel who would benefit from his work, and also, to some extent at least, as the helpers who would have an active share in that work. With that invitation, there went a further implication. The returned from exile Israel must conduct itself in a certain fashion. Nor was this simply a general set of rules, a new abstract ethic. The unique and unrepeatable nature of Jesus' own sense of vocation extended to those who followed him. They were summoned to very specific tasks which had to do with his own career and project. The story of the kingdom thus generated an appropriate praxis among those who heard it and made it their own. Jesus' appeals, commands, and so forth are to be seen not simply as new teaching in the sense of a few new moral rules or theological principles, but as part of the underlying story he told, which aimed to produce in his hearers a realignment of their own praxis, necessarily involving a realignment of the other elements of their worldview also." End quote. Now, those of you who were here yesterday may hear in that quotation, particularly the last part of it, some interesting echoes of what I was saying about ethics not being grounded so much in rules and principles as much as it is in stories and symbolic worldviews. Something very similar to that is what Wright wants to argue, I think, about the nature of Jesus' program and the claim that it made on his followers. Now, out of Wright's lengthy discussion of this kingdom practice and worldview that he talks about, I just want to lift out a few salient points that are of interest for our questions about New Testament ethics. First of all, I want to make five points here. First, Jesus clearly understood himself to be calling and forming a community. He was gathering what Wright calls cells of followers. They may have been scattered through the land of Israel. They weren't like the Essenes who withdrew into the caves at Qumran to live a separated life. They were living in the midst of the people, but nonetheless, they were cells of a gathered community living in a distinctive way as the alternative New Israel, an alternative Israel defined particularly by their allegiance to Jesus. A second point, the character of this community was that it was a new covenant community, and it was therefore characterized by the renewed heart, a changed heart. In accordance with the new covenant promise of Jeremiah 31, the law was to be written on their hearts. And one of the implications of this is that they were to enact forgiveness among themselves. An important saying in this argument is the way that when Jesus prohibits divorce, you notice what he says to the people who are interrogating him. He says, yeah, right, we know that Deuteronomy 24 allows divorce, but Moses gave you that law because of the hardness of your hearts. But it's not so. It's not to be so now. So Jesus is calling, proclaiming a new state of affairs among his followers where no longer hardness of heart is the case, but where the people of the new covenant are given new hearts. Third, this new covenant people is not to make common cause with the resistance movement. Instead, they are called to the way of creative, nonviolent resistance. This is a major theme that Wright hammers home again and again, that they are not to engage in this ultimately self-destructive effort to revolt against Roman authority. Fourth, these people are called to live by the Jubilee principle among themselves. Within these little cell communities, they are called to forgive debts, literally, economic debts, and to pool resources. Fifth, this community is to be a light to the world. Jesus envisioned the redrawing of Israel's boundaries so that these communities would become a light to the Gentiles and reach out to the world in the way the Old Testament prophets had envisioned that God's glory would do. Jesus envisioned that after his death, this community would go on, and here I quote, implementing what he had achieved by becoming Isaianic heralds, lights to the world, end quote. Their witness had to be not just in words, but through actions, in praxis. Another quote, this time from page 660, he writes, "The aim is not simply to believe as many true things as possible, but to act in obedience, implementing the achievement of Jesus, which while spurred and sustained by true belief." All right. Quickly, a few points of critique of this picture of the historical Jesus and his program. I just want to list four points without going into any detail about them where I think that Wright's overall construction is open to challenge, historically speaking. Point number one, did first century Jews in fact generally understand themselves to be in exile? It seems to me that Wright has overstated his case on this point. Certainly, they hoped for a radical eschatological intervention of God. They still hoped for a radical renewal. But it's not clear to me that one can make the case that they thought they were in exile. Now, certainly the Qumran community out there in the caves at the Dead Sea thought that they were in exile. But whether that was characteristic of Judaism more broadly and whether that's what Jesus thought, I'm not yet convinced by Wright's discussion. Secondly, Wright's reinterpretation of eschatology and of this Jewish apocalyptic language tends to focus in on the claim that Jesus fulfilled everything through his death and resurrection. And it leads to the virtual evaporation of any element of future hope in Christian proclamation. Wright has done a great deal of very provocative exegetical work to support this case, but it seems to me that on the whole, it remains hard to account for the pervasive future-oriented eschatological expectation in early Christianity, including the expectation of a future resurrection of the dead, which also nearly disappears from Wright's reconstruction of Jesus and his teaching. So he's left with a problem, which is the problem of what to do with the fact that the world continues and that evil continues. He himself sees this near the end of the book. He writes quite compellingly about it as follows. The real problem is this. Jesus interpreted his coming death and the vindication he expected after that death as the defeat of evil. But on the first Easter Monday, evil still stalked the earth from Jerusalem to Gibraltar and beyond, and stalks it still. Now, it seems to me that Wright's way of reconstructing Jesus leaves us in a very difficult position, and we find it very hard to provide an answer to that question because of the way that he has essentially a realized eschatology. It's not an accident, by the way, that he was a student of George Caird at Oxford, who in turn had been a student of C.H. Dodd, who was the greatest proponent of realized eschatology among 20th century New Testament scholars. Third point of critique. It seems to me that Wright may exaggerate the degree to which Jesus' contemporaries, especially the Pharisees, were implicated in a commitment to a program of violent revolution. This is a very controversial historical point, and many people are strongly skeptical of the way that Wright reads the evidence on this point. And if he's wrong about it, then it makes it harder to give as much focus as he does to Jesus' rejection of that as being really the central cause for God's judgment upon Israel. And the fourth point of critique is that the whole last long section of the book on Jesus' aims and beliefs attributes to Jesus an extremely elaborate and full-blown interpretation of his own death in terms of Old Testament prophetic images and typologies. Now, I'm sympathetic to that move, actually, but the construction is at least vulnerable because of its extreme complexity, and it involves a lot of conjectural moves that I think most historians would find hard to follow. It's a simpler explanation, many people think, that these complicated prophetic typological interpretations emerged over time after the fact, as the early church tried to reflect about the significance of Jesus' death. Well, I've nearly burned my time, but let me, in the last few minutes, offer you some comments on what I think is the significance of all this, of Wright's account, for our understanding of New Testament ethics. I want to make four positive comments about it, that I think ways I think this is very important, and then end by raising two questions. First, Wright's construction of historical Jesus does a great service for New Testament ethics by stressing the theme of continuity with Israel and Israel's heritage. If Jesus' activity pointed towards the creation of a restored Israel, proleptically figured in the community of his disciples, then we as the church need to maintain continuity of our life and witness with the historical Jesus and thereby with Israel. Our identity ought to be grounded in the traditions of Israel. And we must continue to wrestle with issues posed by Israel's election and Israel's unfaithfulness. The struggle with this tension between Israel's election and Israel's unfaithfulness was central to Jesus' career, and I actually think it must remain central for the church. I have, in my Moral Vision book, have devoted a fairly lengthy chapter to the whole problem of the relation of the church's attitude towards Judaism as an ethical issue, and I think Wright's work supports the importance of that undertaking. Second point, where I think he's made a contribution, is in his highlighting Jesus' critique of violence. In Wright's construction, this is absolutely central to Jesus' message and mission. It's not simply a matter of a few sayings sprinkled among others, turn the other cheek, and so on, but instead, Jesus' whole critique of Israel has to do with their adopting the ways of pagan violence. Let me just read you a passage where he says this forcefully. Jesus' kingdom announcement, like all truly Jewish kingdom announcements, came as the message of the one true God, the God of Israel, in opposition to pagan power, pagan gods, and pagan politics. But unlike the other kingdom announcers of his time, from Judas the Galilean to Simeon ben Cosiba, Jesus declared that the way of the kingdom was the way of peace, the way of love, the way of the cross. Fighting the battle of the kingdom with the enemy's weapons meant that one had already lost it in principle and would soon lose it and lose it terribly in practice. He condemned those who compromise with Caesar by playing his power games, and also those who compromised with him by thinking to defeat him with his own weapons. This is integral to Wright's portrait of Jesus, and I think that this is, to the extent that this becomes a historically persuasive account, I would hope that it might move the church more broadly to give fuller consideration to the importance of this element of Jesus' message. Third point. Anchoring Jesus' concerns in real-world history is integral to Wright's project. The future that Jesus envisions, according to Wright, is not an otherworldly destiny in heaven abstracted from this world, but it's a concrete political future for the people Israel in a continuing life on this earth. In many ways, it seems to me, as perhaps some of you will have already thought by now, that in this respect, as in others, Wright's program is actually profoundly congruent with the sketch given in John Howard Yoder's book, The Politics of Jesus. Interestingly, Wright doesn't seem to discuss Yoder or interact with him very much. I'm not even sure how well he knows Yoder's work. I think this is a significant convergence, and it would be an interesting question to pursue. But the point is that according to Wright, the victory of God is to be implemented in human community. It's not something that happens in some otherworldly sphere. Fourth, the community of Jesus' followers is to be characterized by a strong sense of communal life. They're to be forgiving, sharing goods, reaching across ethnic and national boundaries, and of course to be a nonviolent community. So again, I find this focus on community to be both important and profoundly congenial, and again, a very important corrective to this silly picture of Jesus as a wandering philosopher who didn't care anything about community. Now, my two concluding questions for Wright. What about the cross? In my book, I wrote, quoting myself here, "Jesus of Nazareth died on a cross. Those who follow him can hardly expect better treatment from the world. Insofar as the community of faith follows the path of the Jesus of history, it should expect suffering as its lot." But what does Wright's account of Jesus' understanding of his vocation do to my proposal about the image of the cross as an ethical paradigm? Does Wright's portrayal tend to make the cross a one-time event of obedience for Jesus only, focused on one distinct historical moment of crisis, so that Jesus in his own person enacts the penalty, enacts God's judgment and God's victory, but others don't participate in that in the same way. It seems to me that Wright's discussion in this book is not very clear about that point. And my final question is this: more generally, how does this specific historical agenda of Jesus that Wright sketches relate to what we are called to do today? It seems clear that Wright wants to argue that the teachings of Jesus in the Gospels are not timeless general moral admonitions. Rather, they are particular directives for Israel at a particular moment of historical crisis. My question then is, how do we get from there to here? Wright hasn't told us. There is no hermeneutical dimension to this book. Now, in fairness to Wright, I should tell you that this book is only part two of a five-part projected series of volumes on early Christianity, and I do think he intends to get to this question eventually, but he hasn't done it yet. But I think he's given us some clues, and here's my hunch as I read him. Story is the key. Those of us who live now, even many generations later, continue to live out the next act of the drama, as he puts it, implementing the achievement of Jesus as heralds who bear witness to the story through obedient action. If that's correct, it means that we don't necessarily just do exactly what Jesus did or whatever, but that we have to carry on this story. If that's right, Wright's account of the historical Jesus, I think, proves in the end deeply congenial to my proposal that New Testament ethics necessarily involves metaphor making, necessarily involves a continual retelling of the story by our own lives, which correspond in some kind of indirect but analogical way to the character of the New Testament stories. The question for us then becomes this: how do we form the life of our communities so that we carry on the story of return from exile, the story of a restored alternative Israel, and the story of the victory of God? Thank you.